You're listening to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show for Wednesday, October 15th. Richard Pollock filling in the host chair for Drew Mindell, joined in studio by David Manuk of IllegalCurve.com. Special guest, Ezra Ginsberg, who's always special. Michael Remus. Hustler's still here watching the Royals try and take it home all the way to the World Series. If you're wondering, KC is up 2-1 with one out in the top of the ninth inning. Now it's going to be two outs in the top of the ninth inning. We're going to talk hockey tonight for the most part, but we will keep you up to date on the baseball scores. Of course, tonight on NHL Midweek, Ben Kuzma of the Vancouver Province is going to join us later on in the show in the second hour. Talk about the Vancouver Canucks. Totally different vibe out of the West Coast this year after the disaster that the past year and a half had really been in terms of, you know, media, you know, publicity that they were getting, and it was all negative. So it's been already a change this year. And in the first hour, we're going to talk to Stu Grimson, Winnipeg Stu Grimson, about the Nashville Predators. The Predators are in town to face your Winnipeg Jets this Friday evening in the home opener. You can hear that live on TSN 1290. And without further ado, I want to welcome in Ezra Ginsberg and David Manuk. Ezzy?
Yeah, what's going on, boys? It's always an awesome show when Dave Manuk comes in because that means we don't have to spend 2 hours with Drew. So I'm very excited for tonight's show. We got the Royals who are about to sweep the Orioles, and let's get this on, boys.
Well, I don't know. I don't know how I can follow that up after that. Message from Ezzy Ginsberg. I mean, that's either wonderful praise towards me or just tremendous hate towards Drew. I'll take it as the former.
In any event, I wanted to ask you guys about your thoughts about the Winnipeg Jets' start to the season. There, of course, 1-2, having defeated the Arizona Coyotes, on Thursday evening, and then losing Saturday, Sunday in San Jose and Los Angeles. I was on with Rick Ralph on Sunday night for the Kings game, and on Saturday before the Sharks game. So I've had a chance to be on the air and comment on the games. I wanted to hear your opinion, Ezzy, and then Dave, about, you know, about what you think the Jets accomplished this week, and what have they yet to accomplish?
Right, Richie, because they obviously come back with 2 out of 6 points, and they get the big 6-2 win to kick off the season in Arizona, and then they're only able to get 1 goal and 0 points coming out of California. Obviously, the road trip didn't end how the Jets wanted, and you could clearly see that the Winnipeg Jets were tired in that second game in Los Angeles, and I actually thought they played better in San Jose. I think we'd all agree the San Jose Sharks had 8 or 9 power plays in that game. I think it was 8 power plays. Yeah. And the Jets, I thought, actually did a pretty good job to keep it close there. And I thought Andre Pavlik played pretty well. And I thought actually the first line there with Mark Scheifele and Blake Wheeler and Dustin Byfuglien did a pretty good job against L.A. It kind of fell apart, guys, and we saw how the Jets reverted to last year when they don't play their game. I thought that the LA Kings really dictated the pace of the game. And again, the LA Kings do this quite often with almost every single team they play. But if you're looking for more of a positive as opposed to just the wins and losses, and again, I think you got to look at it. They were able to
interrupt,
get the win.
Izzy, it's because there's a real moment here.
Woo!
that's Hustler in the background, the Kansas City Royals. It's a ground ball. Greg Holland induced a ground ball to third base, and the Kansas City Royals just beat the Baltimore Orioles 4-0 in the series and are headed to the World Series.
Well, Huss is obviously pumped up, and as Huss said, only Mother Nature can stop the Royals. So this is a great story. I mean, they haven't lost a game, and they're going to the World Series. Just the best story.
That's what speed do.
I just love being in the room when somebody's team has won something. Like, I always think about, like, you know, he's so excited. And it's great. And, you know, Jets fans, imagine what it would be like, of course, if Jets fans had something to be excited about and could do it all together.
Well, if you don't know that Huss is a big Kansas City Royals fan, you obviously don't listen to the station, but he is the biggest Kansas City Royals fan. We all know that. And again, you really, I think you can't not be happy for the Kansas City Royals, Richie. They haven't made the playoffs in, what, 22, 23, 24 years? So this is just a great story. It's exciting to watch this live.
Dave, your thoughts on the Jets' first week, and of course, you know, you get the high of the Arizona game, maybe the low of the San Jose and Kings game. And what do you take from it all?
A couple things. Well, first of all, you can't think about it without thinking about the loss of Evander Kane and how that looks like it's going to be longer than we thought. I mean, maybe not as bad as everyone suggested originally, but it's not good, obviously, to lose the sniper that early in the season. And the other thing also is that we just learned that you can't take first periods off, because really the Kings and Sharks both dominated the Jets in the first period, and the Jets came back. But I mean, really at that point with those two teams and the leads they had, the games were already out of hand.
Did the Jets take those first periods off, or, you know, from the other perspective, Were they trying to do what they could, and they just couldn't against a team that was playing at top level? But by that I mean, you know, did the Kings and Sharks really exert their force in the first period, then take their foot off the pedal?
Well, there's no doubt that these are two elite teams in the Western Conference. And they have been now for, well, when you're talking about the San Jose Sharks, you're talking about 10-plus years. Yeah. When you're talking about the LA Kings, you're talking about the last 4 years for sure. And I think, you know, you had a combination of both, Richie. I don't think they necessarily played very well in the first. Mm-hmm. But you had two teams that at home... they came out and they came out hard, and they have so many finishers on their teams. And we're talking about LA, you're talking about rolling out three scoring lines, and the same thing goes with the San Jose Sharks. And the one positive is, yeah, you come back to Winnipeg and you're going to have the home opener on Friday against Nashville. You have 4 days of practice. You killed off every single penalty. I mean, that was impressive. And I mean, the Jets, on the other hand, they took too many penalties.
Yeah, they did.
You can't take that many penalties, and that's a sign of playing against a much more talented team. And that's not to you know, give a shot to the Winnipeg Jets, but you're talking about a two-time Stanley Cup champion and the San Jose Sharks, who were very close to beating last year's Stanley Cup champion. So you could see that at certain parts of the game, they had trouble with both the Kings and Sharks' speed. But, you know, they were able to kill off the penalties. I actually didn't think the goaltending was that bad. I think it was a question of them being outplayed.
Before I ask you about that, I want to get Dave in here quickly on this point. I mean, Dave, when you look at the way that they play against the Kings and against the Sharks, the interviews post-game, to me, were a little bit disconcerting, in that it seemed like they were resigned to the fact that they were going to lose. And one of the issues I have is they didn't lose the games 3-2, 4-3. It seems like they have a tough time staying in the games, competitive in the games against really good teams. And, you know, there's a difference between a 4-0, you know, 3-0 loss and a 4-3 loss in overtime. And sometimes, you know, you can play better in the 3-0 loss. Sometimes you can play worse in the 4-3. But the idea is they really weren't in either of those games. And I think taking too much from the third period isn't really a good sign, because when you're up 3-0 in the National Hockey League, you're not really forechecking much. You're just taking a step back.
Well, I think part of it is discipline, and I think that this team is taking too many penalties. And Coach Maurice spoke about it today after practice. He said, you know, we're using a lot of our best guys on the penalty kill. So how much do they have left for the power play?
Is that a good idea, though?
Well, you know, but maybe that's what you need to do, right? I mean, they've been successful. They've killed all the penalties they've taken.
Long term, though.
Oh, yeah. And no, probably not. But I mean, I guess when you're a thinner team, you really don't have an option, right? You have to put those players in, because you don't have, otherwise you're going to give up power play goals, and then really, where are you going to be, right? You'd rather be even, have no, you know, power play goals for, as long as you don't have any power play goals against.
And Dave and Richie, part of that has to do with Evander Kane's out. So he's a guy that plays regularly on the penalty kill. Mm-hmm. So part of that has to do with that. But I mean, you know, back to, you know, talking about how they look like a defeated group. You know, you go down 2-0 to San Jose, you never come back, you don't score a goal there, and then you go into LA the next night, and you get down 2-0, then they get a goal, sure, but it was a pretty inconsequential goal. They lose 4-1. You might have wanted to see a little bit more fight, and I know you saw Blake Wheeler dropping the gloves, and I know we're going to talk about it next segment, you know, against Doan, and then, you know, dropping the gloves again, and that's fine, trying to give his team a bit of a spark, but we're talking about two teams that the Jets have to beat if they want to get to that next level on a regular basis. And these are two teams not in their division, but as far as I'm concerned, Richie, this applies to the Chicagos, the St. Louis's, the Colorados, the teams that have been better than them in the past, and Colorado really just 1 year, but Chicago and St. Louis, these have been teams that have been very good now for 5-6 years. They have to show that they're not intimidated by these teams. And at times they do. Absolutely, Richie. To answer your question, I think sometimes they might go into the game and they might look at, you know, the names on the back of the sweater. They might see Jeff Carter and Andre Kopitar and Drew Doughty, and they might think, I don't know if we can beat these guys. There wasn't necessarily one guy in either of the California games, Richie, that stepped up and looked like he wanted to get this team back into the game.
The Jets last year, just for, you know, for point of reference, were 21-21-8 against the West. They were 9-15-5 against the Central and 12-6-3 against the Pacific. So obviously that's not a good start for, you know, in regards to the Pacific being 1-2. You're listening, by the way, to the NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. I want to get into the goaltending thing, and I think it's probably going to be overblown at this point, because in reality, Andrei Pavlik threw two games in two periods, I guess it would be, or mostly two periods, has been pretty solid. I don't think there's been much of an issue with him. the decision to pull Michael Hutchinson, it's, we're going to put under the microscope, but the, I think, you know, has some long-term ramifications and maybe short-term in the fact that Peter Budaj is now in the organization and at St. John's. What did you guys think about Paul Maurice pulling Michael Hutchinson early in the second period of the third game of the season? And if you listen to his comments after the game, and Rick and I did on the post-game show, didn't seem to be the most confident in the backup goaltender.
You know, it was interesting because he spoke about it today. He said he had a conversation with Hutchinson, that he understood that it was part of the process, and that he didn't think, I mean, that the coach didn't think that it was a significant factor. He just said, you know, it's something that happens in the game. He's trying to give his team a lift. He thought that they could still get into it. And the unfortunate thing for the Jets, if you think about it, for that, at that point in the game, it was 2-0 LA, and before they pulled him. And then Ladd had a really good chance to tie it up, or to pull the Jets within one, possibly get some momentum for the team. And then he led in, Hutchinson led in that third goal, which obviously was the weak one and the one that got him pulled. So, you know, I think the coach pulling him early on, I mean, it's hard to start getting overly, showing too much angst over the goaltending this early, I think.
It's not the goaltending. I mean, you know, Hutchinson had a bad game. Goalies have bad games. To me, it was that Paul Maurice didn't seem to have much confidence in Hutchinson, which, if I want to infer from that, that maybe Paul Maurice was behind the acquisition of a guy like Peter Budaj more so than we anticipated.
Right, Richie, and it's about Paul Maurice's confidence, and it's about Michael Hutchinson's confidence, because if you think about it, he led in 3 goals on 13 shots. Mm-hmm. The first 2 goals were okay goals. The third one was a weak goal. Tanner Pearson's goal was a weak goal. And then you have to, I guess, analyze it from the perspective of, well, is letting Michael Hutchinson stay in that game and possibly give up another 2 or 3 goals, is that going to shatter his confidence or at least weaken his confidence? Or is letting him in or taking him out, I apologize, after 3 goals, is that going to hurt his confidence?
If you're that worried about, but I'm going to get into it, because if you're that worried about it both ways, you don't have confidence in him anyways.
Well, what I'm saying is, like, evaluating whether you think that was the right or wrong decision. That's what I'm saying. I don't know, because you have guys like, you look at Mike Keenan, for example, what he used to do with Eddie Belfour.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying, it depends. There's certain coaches that like to keep the goalie in, right? And then there's certain, like, obviously, the most famous one is Mario Tremblay and Patty Roy, which was his exit out of Montreal. But what I'm saying, Richie, is I don't necessarily agree or disagree with the decision, because he wasn't playing well and they wanted to get back in the game. But should he have maybe given him a chance to start playing better in the game? I don't know. I don't have the answer.
I'm not taking issue with the decision. I mean, I would have left him in personally, but I'm not saying, oh, that's a big deal. I'm saying
You are taking issue with the decision.
Well, no, I'm not taking issue. I would have left him in, but because I thought they were done anyways. They weren't going to win down 3-0 in L.A., and you're trying to save Pavlik to see what he's like as a rested goaltender. So I think there are reasons to leave him in. And you have to show more confidence in him. But the bigger issue is, for me, that I don't think Paul Maurice necessarily has confidence in him based on that move, based on his comments, which then leads me wondering, again, as I said, you know, who was behind the Peter Budaj move, and how soon are we going to see Peter Budaj in Winnipeg?
And Richie, you make a good point, because this is why that decision is important. You have a 5-game homestand coming up, and you've got easier games coming up against Nashville and Calgary. Arguably, Calgary is an easier game. And then you have Carolina. So what happens if Pavlik struggles, and then Hutchinson comes in, or he isn't sure if he should keep Pavlik in there, and then Hutchinson comes in and he's not confident in himself? And again, we don't know what his confidence level is, but it was an interesting move, because it wasn't as if the game was almost over. I mean, this happened early on in the game.
Yeah.
So again, I think, you know, Michael Hutchinson, we haven't seen enough of Michael Hutchinson yet to make snap decisions. And I agree with you. I think Pavlik's been okay, but I think you got to give Hutchinson a few more starts, at least maybe 4 or 5 more starts, before you can decide, you know, should he be back in the AHL?
I'm not disagreeing, but I will put a caveat to the fact that Paul Maurice sees him every day at practice, and we don't. We can see him once in a while, but we don't. And that, again, makes me wonder. I want to go to break, Dave. When we come back, we can continue on that point, and I also want to go and talk about Blake Wheeler dropping the gloves twice in the first 3 games. Do you like it? Do you not? Is it both? We'll hear right after the break. You're listening to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to The Illegal Curve Hockey Show, the podcast, on TSN1290.ca.
Richard Pollock filling in the host chair for Drew Mandel, joined in studio by David Manouk of IllegalCurve.com, Ezra Ginsberg, and producer Michael Remus. You're listening to NHL Midweek with The Illegal Curve Hockey Show, live on TSN 1290. This segment's brought to you by Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, the longest-running independent comedy club in North America. For 30 years, Rumors has been bringing Winnipeg the best in stand-up comedy. To purchase tickets or for a list of performers and showtimes, visit rumorscomedyclub.com. Not sure if you guys thought it was funny or not, but Blake Wheeler got in not only one fight the first week of the season, he got into two. First one, of course, with Shane Doan. That's a big boy. Second one with Robin Regier, who's a bigger boy, or just as big and equally as tough. The first one, I mean, that we should qualify, Shane Doan tried to fight him initiated the fight. The second fight, of course, Wheeler initiated to such an extent that he was given a instigator penalty, 2 minutes and then 10 minutes, and was out of the game for 17 minutes because, of course, he also got a five-minute penalty and was essentially out of the game after the middle of the second period. There's a couple of perspectives on this, and the first one, and I want to hear where you guys stand, and maybe you have a different perspective. The first one being, Blake Wheeler standing up for his teammates, and I like to see that he's passionate and showing a leadership value that maybe the team doesn't have. The other side of it is Blake Wheeler is the best forward on the team, and the team can't afford to lose Blake Wheeler. Maybe once they can afford to lose him, but certainly not twice. And of course, the second time was for far longer than the first time. Where do you stand on this, Ezzy?
Yeah, Richie, I didn't have a problem with it. I guess there's a few issues here with Blake Wheeler dropping the gloves, and I think we could agree here that the fight, quote-unquote, with Shane Doan wasn't much of a fight, and Shane Doan grabbed him. So I don't know if you guys disagree with that, but I don't think that really counts. The two fights in three games, I should say, really was just one fight. I mean, one was a fight, one wasn't really a fight. So let's get that out of there. But this one was, for me, about the timing of the game and really was it the right thing to do. And you look at Blake Wheeler and he's not a fighter. I think he had two fights going into the season, two or three. Mm-hmm. And you look at what he's trying to do and taking himself off the ice, I didn't agree with. I have no problem with anyone fighting. You guys know that I think that fighting in hockey has a place. I mean, that's a much larger debate that we'll probably have later on this season. But you look at Blake Wheeler and he's got the assistant captain designation now, the associate captain designation. And is he trying to do too much? It's possible. But is he trying to do something when nobody else was doing anything as far as scoring or trying to get the team motivated? Not saying that there weren't other hits in the game, but to me, he's obviously a little bit frustrated and he's saying, okay, you know what? I'm going to go after Robin Regier. I know I'm going to get thumped. Robin Regier is a tougher player. He's a stronger player. Even though Blake Wheeler's 6'5", as I mentioned, he's not a fighter. So I don't have a problem necessarily with him fighting. I don't think you're going to see him get into 10 fights this year, Dave. But I guess what my rationale for not really liking the timing of it was that Evander Kane's out of the lineup. You're in the second game of a back-to-back. You take yourself out of the game with the misconduct, and essentially, you're down a player. And so, by the way, I don't think that, Blake Wheeler is making it a point to show that he can drop the gloves or anything like that. I think that it just so happened that spur-of-the-moment thing, that happens in hockey, and I don't think we're going to see it much, and I don't think that anybody should be concerned that this is going to take away from Blake Wheeler scoring goals, because that's what he is paid to do on this team. He's the leading scorer for this team. He's a top 30 NHL forward, in my opinion. So I think that we're looking a little bit too much into it, but I have no problem with guys dropping the gloves. Guys, yesterday's game between the Toronto Maple Leafs and Colorado Avalanche, if you were watching it, the refs broke it up, but Jerome Iginla and Dion Phaneuf were about to fight. You're talking about two captains there. Well, Iggy's
two
a former captain.
Didn't exactly like each other in Calgary.
Right. So,
You know what? It's interesting. I personally don't have any problem with Wheeler doing what he did. I liked it. I especially if you heard his comments after, not necessarily the game after, but during practice a couple days later, he basically was saying that he was standing up for his teammate, and I think people see that and they respect that. And it was an interesting comment he made. He said, "I wish he had done something when Scheifele got hurt in that Islanders game last year." And he felt, it was almost, you could see that it weighed on him that he didn't take any sort of action when Scheifele got injured the first time. And, Scheifele is a critical part of this team. And that was it was a tough hit he took. And so in Blake Wheeler's mind, he wanted to show that you're not going to take liberties with our young guys. So I appreciated the way he stood up for a young player on his team as a guy who is a leader on this team should be doing. Did I think that Blake Wheeler would be leading the NHL in penalty minutes at this point in the season? Obviously still very early, no. But I really don't have a problem with it. I like the passion, and I appreciated the fact that he was willing to stand up for a young player on the team.
Here's Blake Wheeler's comments.
Yeah, I felt like it was knee on knee. So I think if it was the other way, I think somebody would do the same thing. So, no, I do not think I overreacted.
And that was in response to Tim Campbell's question to him after the game in Los Angeles. He got a little defensive. I think Tim's question was pretty innocuous. And well, not innocuous. I think it was the right question to ask. Not everybody would have asked it.
Hold on, what does it innocuous mean?
but that was his reaction. He overreacted, and I think he realized that he overreacted in terms of answering the media and then answered the question, I thought, appropriately. Ezzy, you want to comment on that?
Well, let's be honest here, okay? There's been a lot of talk about fighting, and, you know, it's, I think, apropos that we're having Stu Grimson on, a guy that really wreaked havoc upon the NHL, a tough-as-nails guy in his own time when he played. But for all of this, you know, fighting debate, you know, Colton Orr and Fraser McLaren, you know, getting sent down, not playing for the Toronto Maple Leafs, is there a place for hockey? I think we'd all agree that the staged fighting, we don't agree with any of that. Mm-hmm. That doesn't have any place in the game, but for me, the reason why fighting does have a place in the game, it is a skill, it's to protect your players. So what are you going to do when Hulkamania runs wild on you? What are you going to do when someone's pushing Blake Wheeler around? He's 20 years old, 21 years old now.
Mark Scheifele.
Who did I say?
Blake Wheeler.
Oh, I meant to say Mark Scheifele. What are you going to do when he's getting pushed around? What are you going to do when Jacob Trouba is getting pushed around? As we've seen last night in L.A., Taylor Hall is getting pushed around. Nobody's stepping up to the L.A. Kings in that situation. So in that case, I think fighting has a place. You need to self-police in hockey. Nobody gets hurt. You settle it on the ice. And to me, there's nothing wrong with that.
The reality is that, obviously, that's why you have Chris Thorburn or Anthony Peluso on the team. Those are the guys who are really going to, if anybody, they're kind of patrolling, looking out for the younger players. But, I mean, like I said, ultimately what Wheeler did was he made a snap decision. He saw someone get hit. It wasn't like he took it in, didn't take a liberty two or three shifts later. He did it that while he was on the ice, and it was like heat of the moment, and it was just, you know what, he reacted. And, you know what, to be honest with you, like I said, I approve of it in the sense that he's showing his leadership, and he's really taking over leadership of this team, in my mind.
And I hate the argument that the Chicago Blackhawks and the LA Kings didn't have an enforcer. First off, Jordan Nolan fights. Andy Andreev fought for the LA Kings yesterday. Brandon Bolig fought for the Chicago Blackhawks last year. Maybe it didn't happen in the playoffs, but they still get into fights. So this whole argument that, you know, the good teams don't have fighters anymore, that, you know, the Detroit Red Wings didn't have, well, you know, Todd Bertuzzi's pretty tough. He would drop the gloves if he needed to last year. So, okay, maybe some teams don't have a quote-unquote, you know, enforcer on their team, but they have players that will drop the gloves. So, I mean, again, Blake Wheeler, he's got the A on his chest. He's standing up for Mark Scheifele. Nothing wrong with that.
On the other side of the break, we're going to talk to some guy who used to drop the gloves quite a bit, and I wouldn't have dropped the gloves with him if I had the opportunity. Stu Grimson is going to join us to talk about the Nashville Predators as they're in town on Friday to face the Winnipeg Jets in the home opener, which you can hear on TSN 1290. You're listening to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, the podcast on TSN1290.ca.
Halfway through the hour one of the NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, Richard Pollock filling in the host chair for Drew Mandel, joined in studio by David Manuk of LegalCurve.com, Ezra Ginsberg, and Michael Remus.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show hotline.
Jets played their first three games of the season on the road on the West Coast, but they head home, or are home right now, to face the Nashville Predators on Friday night. And Nashville Predators TV color analyst Stu Grimson is kind enough to join us. Stu, how are you tonight?
Hey, I'm well, guys. How's everybody there?
We're doing pretty well. The weather is nice, and we're looking forward to Friday's game and looking forward to seeing, you know, a kind of a new-look Predators team. I watched most of last night's game against Calgary, and the up and down style that the Predators are playing is certainly, you know, kind of a contrast to last year's team and the teams before that. Stu, how are the fans, first off, how are the fans taking to that new style?
Oh, I think they're liking it. You know, there's a lot more to pay attention to when the game clock is running. There's a lot more going on. Tend to do things in motion a lot more. I guess I refer specifically to the power play, you know, a lot of moving parts, moving pieces, a lot of activity. But at the base, I think this team tends to play just flat out more aggressively, more on your toes. And, you know, if you're going to, you could draw a continuum, clubs that play a very defensive style, the clubs that play a very offensive style and aggressive style. And the Preds have definitely kind of shifted, the indicator down the aggressive end of the continuum here. So, it's been fun to watch, and our folks seem to be getting a real charge out of it. You know, we played three games to open the season, possible potential 6 points on the line. They got five of them. Mm-hmm. Pretty positive, you know, three first games out of the gate.
Stu, you just mentioned the Nashville Predators have played three games, so it's obviously early, but what have your impressions been so far of the new additions on forward, James Neal, Mike Ribeiro, Derek Roy, and former Winnipeg Jet Olli Jokinen?
Well, I think at bottom, this team is just deeper offensively than it has been in the past. I think there are really, you know, there may have been, you know, one or two lines that could hurt you last year. I think from what we've seen so far, and, you know, we really haven't even seen James Neal contribute in a significant way, that first line contribute in a significant way. I think this team's going to get a real kind of balanced contribution from lines one through four. In fact, you know, and kind of proof of the point, one of the strongest offensive lines so far has been that Gostad group, Taylor Beck on one mm-hmm. side and Eric Nystrom on the other side, scored some key goals for us and been, you know, very much you know, a 200-foot group that played well at both ends of the ice.
Stu, a player people don't know a lot about is Craig Smith. Is he poised for a breakout year?
Yeah, I think he is. I think Craig is a guy. I mean, confidence matters to everybody. It's confidence that I think has held Craig Smith back from being a real impact player. But he's really, I think, as much as he's grappled with that, I think he has adjusted to the pace of the NHL. He recognizes he has a place in the NHL, and he's starting to add to his game. I see him thinking the game, slowing the game down in his head a little more, and he really is a guy that puts plays together every time he's out there. It was part of a key goal last night, kind of a little one-time shot that ends up at the side of the net on Ribeiro's stick that he bangs home, you know, for a rather easy marker. But that's a Craig Smith type play, dynamic in and around the net front. And I really do think conservatively this is a guy that should add anywhere from 10% to 20% to his game this year, because we've not yet found the ceiling on Craig Smith. I think there's more there.
Joined by TV color analyst of the Nashville Predators, Stu Grimson. Stu is in his first season doing color for the TV angle with Pete Weber, of course, the legendary Pete Weber. You know, Stu, I look at that game last night, and having watched the Predators before and even back to last year, you look at that right side of the defense. You have Shea Weber, now you have Seth Jones and Ryan Ellis. Is there a better puck-moving right side of a defense, one through, I guess, three in the National Hockey League than those three guys?
I know. It is rather remarkable. And I've been saying for a good long stretch now, you know, from the blue line back, I think this is as formidable a team as there is in the NHL. We've got a solid group of defenders, guys that can really get the puck up the ice, guys that defend well in their own zone, guys that are very creative on special teams when they're working the blue line. Ryan Ellis is a pleasure to watch. Second unit power play, typically quarterbacking from that right point side. He just does so many things that are just so very innovative. He's a real bright player, a guy that I think is perhaps one of the smartest on our team. He, you know, in spite of his rather modest stature, he's a guy you no longer worry about the question, oh, is he big enough to play in the NHL? Ryan Ellis is just, he's a factor more nights than not.
Stu, Nashville Predators head coach Peter Laviolette, he's always played an up and down style, but he's never had a goalie like Pekka Rinne, maybe with the exception of Cam Ward. How much does that help to have a guy like Rinne as he employs the team's new system?
Yeah, you know, clubs tend to play different, perhaps with more confidence, in front of certain goaltenders. And I think really at the bottom of that, there is a trust factor. And I say that to make the point that this team really trusts Pekka Rinne, because he is not one to give up a soft goal, not very often. And he is a guy that is just so competitive. He battles for every shot, every scramble around the net, you know, as competitively as anybody I know, coupled with his raw athleticism and his range, his great big rangy frame. He just he's a superb goalie. He's a treasure to watch every night out. And I guess we go kind of circle back to the original point we're making. When you've got a guy like that playing between the pipes for you, you can take some chances, knowing that the odds are quite good he's gonna come through and bail you out when needed.
Does Anton Volchenkov have enough left in the tank to be a helpful player for the Preds this season?
You know, I think Anton is a really smart signing. When you look at the complement of other defenders we've got in the mix, Anton is a guy that brings some grit, some veteran presence. He is a workaday NHLer. He's a guy that comes to the rink. You get the same game from him every night. And I said this the other night after the Dallas game. I speak a little Russian, guys. Volchenkov translated into English means wrecking crew. He had three shifts the other night, three hits the other night, where, I mean, it was just humanity flying all over the place. He really is effective. Again, this is in a specific kind of, I wouldn't say restricted role, but a very defined role. You're looking for him to carve a good chunk of penalty-killing time every night. You're looking for him to just play steady in his own end, and you're looking for him to be hard on opposition forwards, top six forwards, really, and we've seen him play against that group. So he's a nice, right now, Coach Laviolette has him alongside Seth Jones, and that's a nice pairing. I think that's going pretty well. Again, we'll make this point in just about every comment we make tonight. It's a small sample size, mm-hmm. but I like those two guys together in the early going.
Stu Grimson joins us on NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. Of course, former NHL player for 17 seasons, now doing TV color for the Nashville Predators, who are in town on Friday for the Jets home opener. Stu, Philip Forsberg acquired by the Preds for Martin Irad, who everybody, I think, thinks that was a real nice deal for the Preds. Seems, again, you talk about young players, Craig Smith, and confidence. It seems to me, again, small sample size, as you mentioned, that Philip Forsberg seems more confident this year than he was last. Do you agree with that?
I really do. And we're on to one of my favorite topics of this young 2014-15 season, because coming into this season, one of the key questions for the Preds was, is Philip Forsberg added enough pace to his game, rounded out his game, to stay at this level and be an impact player? I think he's answered that question quite decisively. The sample size is a little bit bigger with Philip Forsberg because he comes into rookie camp. He's asked to play a four-team tournament there back in the early stages of September before main camp opens up. He's MVP of a whole complement of players from the Bruins, the Tampa, the Florida, the Predators camp. He's far and away the best player in camp. Carries that into the preseason, where I think he was our leading point getter. And, it's been a very simple, smooth transition right into the regular season. He's out there, you guys. He makes plays. You'll have the opportunity to watch him in a couple of nights. Watch the finer points of his game. Watch the way he changes the angle of his blade. Watch the way he'll, if he's forced to kind of waste a puck, dump a puck, he'll put it in front of a fellow forechecker rather than just put it into some dead space where you can't really do anything productive with it. He's a fun guy to watch. The more you watch him, the more you begin to realize, hey, this is a pretty smart player. And again, one of the original points I wanted to make on Philip Forsberg, he's added some pace to his game. That's mm-hmm. the one thing that was lacking. And I think that coupled with this, the way he thinks and plays the game in the finer, smaller areas, I think we got a special player here.
Stu, we got to ask you about someone who Winnipeggers are really curious about, and that's Colin Wilson, who, of course, is the son of former NHLer Kerry Wilson, who played many years with the Calgary Flames. Is this a make-or-break year, in your opinion, for Colin Wilson?
I think it is. I think it is. Because if I'm kind of hockey operations, at a table with the decision-makers in this organization, I'm sure there are people that are saying, hey, we really like Colin. He's going to be an impact player for us. And there's other people that say, hey, we too like Colin. Thinking he would have, offered, produced, provided more by this stage in his development. So I do agree. I think a pivotal moment, a pivotal time in his career. I think the key thing for Colin, he's got great raw physical tools. He's very strong on the puck, hard to knock off the puck, when he's in high gear. It's just a matter of being in high gear on a night-to-night basis. He's recognized that as a challenge, so I'm not saying anything terribly controversial. He'll, you know, he'll be given a great opportunity to sort that out and to play through that. If he does, I really think the game's his oyster.
Stu, we've got one last question for you here. Last segment, we were talking about Blake Wheeler dropping the gloves on Sunday night against the Los Angeles Kings, and I'm sure you get this question a lot. You know, you used to fight back in the day. According to DropYourGloves.com, you actually got into 386 fights, and you won probably most of those fights.
So 386 more than any of us.
The debate, especially at the beginning of each year, seems to always revolve around fighting's place in hockey, and you see a team like the Toronto Maple Leafs who aren't going to be dressing Colton or Fraser McLaren much this year. I'm just going to ask you straight up, in your opinion, why does fighting have a place in hockey still?
Well, two reasons primarily, and I'll qualify my comments on the back end of my comment. Two reasons primarily. My primary justification as a player, an important part of why I was on the roster, lending physical support, making it easy for the smaller, the skilled guys in my lineup to play. Second piece, we saw an instance of that just a few nights ago when Nashville and Dallas locked horns. It's to turn a game around. It's to ignite your bench if your team is flat, and it's amazing to me. Paul Gostad goes out. Team is trailing by a score of 1-0. He gets into a scrape with Vernon Fiddler, gets the better of him. And you know what? You could point back to that moment in the game, and you could say from that point forward, the Preds surged. I said this repeatedly on the broadcast. They surged, and then ultimately were able to translate that momentum into actual tangible statistical results. It's a strange thing if you're not familiar with our game, but when a guy goes out and he does that for his team, it gets noticed by the bench, and that team often gets going in the right direction. It happens far more times than it doesn't. Now, I will say back to my other point, though, about making it easier for the smaller, more skilled people to play. I don't know that justification stands up like it used to back when I played. And, you know, proof to the point is most of the general managers around the NHL really don't see the need to dress a heavyweight-type player anymore. I think what we're looking at in the future, guys like Chris Neal from Ottawa that can play the game, mm-hmm. guys like Milan Lucic who are big, forceful, very effective as players but can also take care of business when the time is appropriate, those guys will be coveted. Those guys will bring a certain set of tangible assets that others can't. Those guys will be in big demand. But I really do think fighting will stay in the game. Those are the guys that will be doing it.
Stu Grimson, TV color analyst for the Nashville Predators. Look forward to seeing you on Friday, and thanks so much for your time tonight.
Hey, my pleasure. Pleasure to be on with you guys.
It's really great stuff. A really interesting take on the Nashville Predators in general, and of course on fighting at the end there. Looking forward. The Predators are exciting to watch, guys. Different team than years past. Really exciting game last night. When we come back, the Florida Panthers attendance woes started earlier than usual this year. It's already a topic of a conversation around the league. They had their lowest attendance for the opening game, and then, of course, a very poor attendance for game two against the Ottawa Senators. When we come back, we're going to talk about that, and then, of course, Bob McKenzie's comments about expansion. You're listening to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, the podcast on TSN1290.ca.
If you're just joining us on the NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290, you just missed Stu Grimson, TV color analyst for the Nashville Predators, of course, former heavyweight and former resident of Winnipeg, breaking down fighting in the NHL. That was an interesting question as he asked him, and an interesting answer as well. And, of course, the Nashville Predators and kind of the young talent they have and the change kind of in the vibe in Nashville. Quickly, before we talk about Florida, this segment's brought to you by Dr. Les Rikus and the Linden Market Dental Center. Whether an elite athlete or a weekend warrior, an essential part of your protective equipment is a proper fitting, custom-made mouthguard. Give yourself peace of mind protection as well as facial, teeth, and mouth protection. Contact the Linden Market Dental Center at 204-487-2226 or online at lindenmarketdentalcenter.com. Well, you know, you see the speculation as to the Florida Panthers, but let's just quickly qualify our statement that they're very low on attendance in the first two games. The Florida Panthers, this is from George Richards of the Miami Herald. The Florida Panthers announced attendance tonight. This is for the second game of the year. 7,311 people, and that sets the record for the lowest in franchise history. The previous low was 10,063 against Carolina. You read this morning, Elliot Freeman in his 30 Thoughts talked about the fact that Florida's trying to cut down on freebies, and so butts in the seat. And by the way, if you watch the game, 7,000 was not the butts in the seat, that was the sold tickets. Certainly leaves you a little bit concerned about the viability of the team in the long term if they're not able to turn it around quickly and win some games. Ezzy, what are your thoughts on all that?
Well, Richie, I know that you've heard about the ironclad lease and the fact that the new ownership of the Florida Panthers is in it for the long term. On the topic of the ownership, we know it's new ownership with Vinny Viola there and another owner there. And so really the issue here is how long can they sustain a franchise when they have crowds like that? And we're obviously not here to pile up on the Florida Panthers.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you saw a lot of pictures on Twitter of the crowd. I don't think I've seen that many pictures of a crowd since, the days when there weren't a lot of fans going to Jobbing.com Arena. So everyone saw the pictures. The crowd wasn't good. The question for me, really the most important question here, and, we can get to relocation and all that, but relocation is a long time away, guys. So the topic here is, as far, they've had trouble drawing fans in Florida to the BB&T Center. And they've had trouble drawing fans in Florida for a long time now. And the team hasn't had a lot of success. Back, 3 years ago, they went to the playoffs and against the New Jersey Devils. But it was a team that before that hadn't made the playoffs. And they've only made the playoffs a few times in their 20 or so years there. But for me, it's, if they don't start getting more fans to the games, how long can they sustain? You hear, about $20 million a year in losses. And I have no idea how accurate that is. But I would love to see more fans in Florida. You never want to see a team have that type of support issues. We went through this in Winnipeg. We lost our team. So let's just qualify that right now. We don't want to see the Florida Panthers go anywhere. But to me, the new ownership there, how long can they sustain these types of losses, these types of crowds?
They've committed to the team and they spent a bunch of money this offseason. So the worrisome part to me, if I'm a Florida Panthers fan or if I'm attending or not, is usually you spend a lot of money on a team, the fans get excited and then they come to the games. And then if they don't perform well, then maybe they back off. And I know October is a tough month to sell tickets. And I know Florida in general, Miami specifically, is tough to sell tickets anyways.
Right, Ottawa isn't a big draw.
Right, exactly. But the Devils, the first game in the East Coast, you think they'd have more people there. But the idea is, the Heat are going to have trouble selling tickets now without LeBron James. The Dolphins have trouble selling tickets. The Marlins, everybody sees those games. So it's not like lots of people are going to games in South Florida, and that's the worrisome part. I thought it was a good tweet from the Florida Panthers. Loyalty is best earned on the back of virtue, honor, and integrity. Together we climb, and thanks to all who came. That was to the Florida Panthers fans, but clearly, you're reaching out to them, and you're hoping that the loyal supporters will stick with you. You need to hope for more than just the loyal supporters. You need to hope for new fans, and that's where you wonder where they're going to get them, Dave.
Yeah, my parents were actually at the game on Monday, and they said that it was pretty empty. I mean, personally, I don't like seeing people pile on a franchise when they're struggling like that. Look, you can point it out, but it seems like the joy that people take out of this sort of negative.
Why Twitter exists?
Yeah, no, that's true to a large degree, and it's unfortunate because you just see people, and it's like thinking to myself, Winnipeg used to struggle at times. Mm-hmm. We had terrible crowds sometimes. You really need people to point that out. So I just don't understand why people feel this need to wow. Florida's doing, everybody knows that they're doing poorly. They're not drawing. And there's a multitude of factors. I'm not being a Florida apologist. I don't really care one way or another for Florida. But I'm just saying, it was a Monday. It was a Monday of a holiday in the States. And it was against a team that doesn't draw particularly well in October. There's not a lot of snowbirds there. So, I mean, there's a multitude of factors for why maybe the game didn't draw super well. I mean, obviously, it's unfortunate because Florida, you're right, the ownership did seem to, kind of say that we're prepared to step up and, support this team. We need the fans to support us. So who knows? You might see bigger crowds later in the year, and hopefully, for their case, that happens.
It's going to be interesting to see what happens. Bob McKenzie had a tweet, and this is what the tweet said. This is on October 14th, so this is yesterday. Bob McKenzie, of course, TSN. I can see it being a 33-team league with Seattle, Las Vegas, and Quebec City. I don't think the NHL is hung up on a round number. Put me down for 33. doesn't make reference at all there to anybody moving yet. And I know that there are some concerns. But with new ownership, I think that new ownership's committing to this to try and make it work. It's been, what, season two?
The only thing I would say also is that I like the fact that they're not giving away free tickets anymore. Because there's nothing worse than sitting in the crowd knowing you spent $200 total, you know, to go to the game. And you're sitting beside a guy who said, yeah, they, you know, I had a Visa card and they gave me a free ticket. That's infuriating. So the reality is that, you know what, maybe there's fewer people in the stands, but at least they're paying. As opposed to the fans who are just, you know, you might have 3,000 more. Great, it looks better. You know, the optics look better. But the reality for that team, that's not helping.
And in the day of social media, with all the tweeted out pictures, it's going to look worse than it would have 15, 20 years ago when you were trying to get through these growing pains.
Right, exactly.
You know? Yeah, and Richie, it'll get better. I mean, it's early on in the season. And to have a solid ownership group, and there's no doubt in my mind that the ownership group, the management, the marketing department, everybody wants this to work and wants to see more fans in the stands. So you never want to see these small crowds, but you have to hope it's going to get better. And no, you don't want to see that. We want to see all the rinks full in the NHL, right?
That would be ideal, as they, of course, and then it'd be a fruitful National Hockey League and everybody would get paid and everybody would be happy. The Vancouver Canucks weren't happy last year. A little happier this year, and we're going to check in with Vancouver Province writer Ben Kuzma on the other side of the break to see what's going on with the Canucks. You're listening to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, the podcast on TSN1290.ca.
Halfway through NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. Richard Pollock filling in the host chair tonight for Drew Mandel, joined in studio by Ezra Ginsberg, David Manuk of IllegalCurve.com, and Michael Remus.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
We're joined on the IC Hotline by Ben Kuzma of the Vancouver Province. We've had Ben on a number of times to talk about, you know, the disaster that was the Canucks for the past year and a half or so. Ben, we're having you on today to talk about the different mood around this team, and how different is it?
Well, it is different. You know, you sense it in the room. I think you sense it in the city. I think there's a cautious optimism about what could be at play here in Vancouver this year. I mean, when you make the changes that they made in management, the behind the bench with the roster, you know, we've talked about this, and I hate to bring it up for 104th time, but a lot of the drama has been removed in Vancouver. And, you know, you couple that with a system that the players can actually play, an up-tempo, entertaining system, that's predicated on puck movement. You get some decent goaltending, a new look with the power play. And, you know, I don't know what that equates to. If it's 10 or 12 more wins, they might challenge for the final playoff spot in the conference. You know, let's not kid ourselves. The top eight spots are, they're not a lock. Somebody's going to have to fall off. But I think the Canucks will at least be in the hunt for a wild card position. And you couldn't really say that a year ago.
Ben, the new mood, the breath of fresh air that seems to be around Vancouver and the team, how much of that is a product of new GM Jim Benning and new coach Willie Desjardins?
I think a lot of it is. I mean, say what you want about Trevor Linden being brought on as president. You know, there's lots of optics at play here. I mean, you're talking about a franchise that suddenly had thousands of season tickets up for sale, that had empty corporate suites, and you know, Trevor being brought on board, as much as he wants to get involved in everything, it's all new to him. But he was wise enough to understand that Jim Benning, really his body of work, not only in Boston, but in a scouting capacity when he's with the Buffalo Sabres, is pretty impressive. The thing I like about Jim Benning, he doesn't say much, but he does a lot. All you have to do is look at what happened here before and at the draft, and being able to move players like Ryan Kessler and Jason Garrison. I'm not sure that would have occurred in the previous regime, having the wherewithal to get a pick and move it to L.A. and get, you know, Lyndon Vey, who Willie Desjardins is very well connected with from his Medicine Hat days, a former Western Hockey League scoring champion who really couldn't fit in L.A. because, you know, the Kings are ridiculously deep down the middle. Understanding that Derek Dorsett, who also played for Willie Desjardins in Medicine Hat. So you got a couple of players, you already know what you're going to get from them. They have a good synergy with the coach, and I think it's really important. You know, Benning is a proven commodity, and Willie Desjardins has won at every level, except that an NHL head coach. He's coming off a Calder Cup championship with the Texas Stars, and I think this was the next logical step. These two guys were were on the radio, on the radar from the get-go, and there's a real symmetry here. You know, I was working on a piece today just talking about how things are working at that level and how there's a real connection to what's happening with the American Hockey League team in Utica. And, you know, giving a guy like Ryan Jones, the former Oilers winger, a PTO, because you know what? He's a pretty gritty player. And when you play in this division and you go into LA or San Jose or Anaheim, you might need that kind of element. We know guys are going to get hurt, but what I like here is the fact that they're not only preparing for the present, they're taking a hard look at the future, and you can't really put you know, a figure on that. You know, so far so good. You know, it's only been two games, but they seem to be pointed in the right direction.
Ben, how has Radim Vrbata looked alongside the Sedins?
Like he's been playing there for 10 years. I mean, he's a right-hand shot, okay? The thing I liked about Vrbata, I thought this organization should have taken a run at him before when he became a free agent, much like Vermette, you know, when he left Columbus and went to Phoenix. I thought there was a guys there that could have really helped the Canucks. But Vrbata, he's a goal scorer. And one thing about him is that as a right-handed shot, he already knows where to go. I mean, there seemed to be a lot of consternation here about, yeah, Vrbata does play like the Sedins. Is that too much of the same element on one line? Well, I can tell you right now that the chemistry is already there after a couple of games. And the power play, you know, that was 26th in the league last year. I mean, there's no way it's going to be the 26th. I mean, they should be at least mid-pack. And they're trying some different looks. Four forwards on the first unit. Lyndon Vay there with Alex Edler as a trigger guy in the point. So they're doing a lot of different things there. They're running a 1-3-1. When a guy gets the puck on the wall or if Edler gets the puck at the point, there's more options at play. That didn't happen last year. The Canucks were so predictable in their power play, and they stood around. There was no movement, and it was so easy to defend. So that's a big step in the right direction here. Perry Perrin has a lot to do with that. Of course, the former Winnipeg assistant coach has really brought some new looks to the power play, and the early returns aren't bad. So, again, there's another thing that was just horrible last year that's already been turned around.
Joined by Ben Kuzma of the Vancouver Province on NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Ben, Nick Bonino is a guy, you know, I've watched quite a bit, and a guy I always pictured as kind of a good seventh forward on a really good, on a cup contending team. What's your read on him?
Well, it's not a cup contending team, so I mean, you're trying to replace Ryan Kessler, and I think where they miss Kessler the most right now is in the faceoff circle, where the Canucks have struggled. Bonino's around 47%, which isn't bad, but I think he's a better player than he's given credit for. People make a lot of his 22 goals last year, a lot of them coming on that power play when he got a chance to play with Getzlaff and Perry. I found him pretty good. What I like with him, he's a smart player. He's a good puck distributor. The second line here in Vancouver has always been a big concern about, you know, the big knock here was, well, Kessler didn't have anybody to play with, but he didn't distribute the puck that well. Bonino will do that, but can, you know, the Canucks get anything out of Burrows? Can they get anything out of Higgins? You know, will Zach Cassian ever play on the second line? So there are a lot of question marks there, but I think Bonino was one of their better players in the preseason, and it's been one of those, again, it's only been two games, a couple of wins over Calgary and Edmonton, but Bonino looks like a player who's going to only evolve as he goes on here, and once they set that second line, I think he's at least one of those guys that you can certainly peg for 20-plus goals.
Ben, you mentioned Lyndon Vay earlier, and I agree with you. I think he's a really good player. He's going to add a lot to the Vancouver Canucks' depth. Really fun player to watch, too. I want to ask you about another Saskatchewan boy, Derek Dorsett, who was acquired.
Yeah.
What has he brought to the team? Because he obviously has a lot of playoff experience and and toughness experience, I guess, with the New York Rangers.
Yeah, when I think about Dorsett, I think about, you know, every time when the Canucks would play, whether it was Columbus or the Rangers or whoever, you always noticed him. Because he did something to irritate the other team, or he'd go to the net hard, or he'd bang in a garbage goal or whatever. I think when you look in this division on a given night who you play, I mean, Derek Dorsett has shown an ability to play on the third line. Some nights he might play on the fourth. But against skilled teams, he'll be in the lineup every night. Tom Cicito hasn't played through two games on the fourth line because the Canucks figure, you know, we want four lines to play. We want our fourth line guys to play 10 minutes, not six. And can an enforcer type like Cicito sustain that? That's a big thing here. But let's not kid ourselves. When they go to L.A., you know Cicito's going to be in the lineup, and so is Dorsett. So I think they're prepared for stuff like that, and understanding that They've got to have a team that's tailored depending on the opposition on a given night. And again, I don't think that was the case a year ago.
Ben, who would you say is the leader on this team?
That's a really good question. I still think that leadership has to come from above. I think, you know, Sedin's take a lot on their shoulders. Henrik Sedin is your captain. But when I think about the pulse of the team, I kind of look at Kevin Bieksa. You know, he's been here a long time. He's been through everything, the ups and downs. You know, he wears a letter, and he's a big part of the shutdown pairing when they decide to go that way. He will get involved offensively. And one thing I've noticed about the Canucks are two games, they're back to being a little bit more of a physical club. You know, they got a half a dozen guys with five or six hits through the first couple of games. I mean, Dan Hammes, for crying out loud, fought Ryan Nugent-Hopkins here the other night. Alex Edler looks like the Alex Edler we saw a few years ago. He's not afraid to dish out a hit in his own zone, neutral zone, or whatever, and pick his spots properly. But I think Kevin Bieksa is kind of the pulse of the team because when he plays well and he plays aggressively, it seems to spin off. He's a pretty good go-to guy in the room. You know, I talked to him today about, you know, what's happening with the hockey club, and I think he's got a pretty good head on his shoulders, and he's a pretty strong voice in that room. And if you were to ask me to peg one guy, it's probably him.
Joined by Ben Kuzma of the Vancouver Province, talking about the Vancouver Canucks and, you know, the changes over on the West Coast. You know, Ben, you look at the defense, it really hasn't changed too much personnel-wise, but how much has it changed in terms of style of play?
Well, style of play is, you know, it's the antithesis of what they did a year ago. For some reasons, the Canucks adopted this zone defense approach a year ago, which basically means, you know, if the other guy's got the puck in the corner, don't really engage him physically, stand off and protect the area. I think what they were concerned about a year ago was that guys come out of the corner spinning out with the puck and we need enough guys down low. Well, what you get are guys playing not like they're wired to play, not engaging guys physically, you know, crashing down around your net and everybody stick-checking each other. It's gotten back to the way they used to play, especially in 2011. Engage guys physically, win board battles, and let's get the puck moving in a hurry. And that transcends into puck possession and gaining the zone with the puck. And that's really been evident in the first couple of games. So, again, it's about a system that the players are more accustomed to playing as opposed to ramming a round peg in square hole a year ago. So, you know, that works in your favor as well.
Ben, we got to ask you about Ryan Miller, and obviously he's got a couple of wins in the first little bit of the season here, but we wanted to ask you specifically about how Ryan Miller has taken to the city of Vancouver after signing in the offseason, and how Vancouver hockey fans have adopted Ryan Miller.
Well, I think it's going to be a work in progress. I mean, you know, it doesn't matter what happens here. We always have the microscope focused on the crease and what's going to occur there. I'll give Ryan Miller props because I think he understands what's at play here. I mean, you know, this isn't the only market that takes a close look at its goaltenders. He played extremely well in Buffalo last year, and then when he went to St. Louis, the transition was tough. It's a team that doesn't give up many shots, and Ryan Miller's accustomed, you know, to seeing a lot of rubber, especially when he played with the Sabres. You know, had a 93% save percentage, and it was very good in that respect. I think what's happened here, and certainly the last game here with the Oilers, is the fact that, you know, he got better as the game went on. And in the third period, especially in the overtime, and especially in the shootout, he was rock solid. And I think he's getting his game under him. Rolly Malance, the goaltending coach here, wants him to play a little bit deeper in his crease. That's a challenge. I mean, Ryan, he's a little stubborn. He likes to be very aggressive. He's usually on top of the paint and sometimes outside of the paint. But I think he's also willing to compromise. And that's what I think will hold them in good stead here. And it's going to be interesting to see how they use the goalies here. I mean, they have a double dip coming up on the weekend with Edmonton on Friday and Tampa here on Saturday. Eddie Lack will probably get one of those games. I'm not sure which one it is. But, again, with Miller, I'd say so far so good.
Sure to be less dramatic, Ben, probably than it was in previous years. So,
oh, yeah.
We appreciate you joining us. Ben Kuzma, the Vancouver Province. Thanks, as always. And we look forward to speaking to you in the months to come.
Okay, take care.
The Vancouver Canucks, by the way, as Ben said, totally reformed their roster, and I think they're in way better shape than they were 5-6 months ago. That's a lot of activity by Jim Benning, and I think he was very assertive. And there's a few GMs around the league I think probably take, you know, a page from his book and would be well served to do so. When we come back, Eric Staal is apparently on the trade block, and guess who's interested in Eric Staal? The Toronto Maple Leafs.
Who?
Exactly. We're going to talk about that and more when NHL Midweek continues. You're listening to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, the podcast on TSN1290.ca.
Well, very interesting, but the key word is if Eric Staal is available. But I know this, the Toronto Maple Leafs have had discussions with the Carolina Hurricanes in the past, most recently in the summer, about the potential availability of the Carolina Hurricanes captain. Now, the asking price, if Eric Staal is available at any point this season prior to the NHL trade deadline, is going to be enormous. It would include a first-round pick. You're talking about either Tyler Bozak or Nazem Kadri, because the center would have to go back, and likely Jake Gardner. But I believe that's the price Toronto would pay.
That's the voice of Darren Dreger of TSN talking about Eric Staal, the Carolina Hurricanes possibly being available for trade, and of course the interest, alleged interest, of the Toronto Maple Leafs. Richard Pollock in the host chair for Drew Mandel this evening on NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290, joined in studio by Ezra Ginsberg and David Manuk of IllegalCurve.com, and of course Michael Remus between the TVs and the monitors there, doing a great job as always. First off, it sounded like Darren Dreger was in a rock band there for a second. I'm going to be the first one to say that Eric Staal has a big ticket left, okay, guys? And I think that's the first thing that needs to be said. His contract is significant. He's at $8 million, and it's not long in terms of duration, but it's a high price. So it's $8.25 million cap hit for this year and next. I'll provide my commentary first in terms of the package that Darren Dreger stated there. You know, it would be Nazem Kadri likely, or Bozak, but likely Kadri, and Jake Gardner, and a first-round pick. I don't love that package. But, you know, can you re-sign Eric Staal? Will Eric Staal be as effective on his next contract when speed is an element of his game? And, you know, there's sometimes he doesn't bring it every night, too, and he's a little bit inconsistent, so... You know, it's hard to sign a guy like that, and there's apparently a willingness from Eric Staal to waive his no-trade clause and go to Toronto, so that's always helpful because, as Don Cherry pointed out, it's not like they're drafting Ontario boys in Toronto. I would think, though, that there would be other people, other teams in the mix here who could put a package together better than Kadri, Gardner, and a first. We haven't even talked about the fact that the Leafs probably shouldn't be trading away first-round picks, but that's for another day. Do you think that Staal being picky about where he's going, he can kind of control possibly going to Toronto and maybe limit the options Carolina has? I think that might be what's happening here, Ezzy.
Yeah, I think you make a really good point, Richie. And to me, Eric Staal's a pretty interesting case here because you have so many factors at play, Richie. Mm-hmm. Jordan Staal's out of the lineup now. Obviously, Eric Staal had a big part of getting... him there. Jordan Staal there. You actually have Jared Staal in the system as well. He's the brother who doesn't play much in the NHL.
Might be the first line center by the end of the year. He might be the first line center.
Four Staal brothers, of course. But you have so many factors at play here because the Carolina Hurricanes aren't a good hockey team this year. And that was before Jeff Skinner and Jordan Staal went out with injuries. Yeah. So you had a team here that was a long shot to make the playoffs, at least in my opinion, and I think you guys would probably agree with that.
They're the worst roster in the league, probably.
It's a rebuild here for the Carolina Hurricanes. We've talked about good players, Elias Lindholm, other players that they have. There's good players coming through the system. But the factors that to me that are really interesting are who wants Eric Staal? What are they willing to pay? Mm-hmm. Does Eric Staal, as you mentioned, want to go to what team does he really want to go to? Obviously, he's from Ontario, so the Toronto Maple Leafs make a lot of sense. We know that the Maple Leafs were interested in acquiring Eric Staal last year. There's a lot of money. Whoever's getting Eric Staal better make sure they have the cap room. They're going to have to send back quite a bit of salary the other way. So as the season progresses, and I think that's why Darren Dreger, Pierre LeBrun, and Bob McKenzie were talking about this last night on TSN, or two nights ago on TSN, because when you think about, okay, who's really in play here? Well, you're going to start to look at some of the teams that are out of the playoff picture. The Carolina Hurricanes, obviously, it's too early in the season to say they're out of the playoff picture. But I think there's a good chance...
No, they're out of the playoff picture, I'll say that.
I think that he gets moved. And the reason why I think there's a good chance that he gets moved is because even though Eric Staal has only been with one franchise, he's got a Stanley Cup, he has to be looking at, you know, the next few years and saying, okay, well... Am I going to stay here for the rebuild? Because it is a rebuild.
What's Toronto?
And there's a new GM there. There's a new coach there. And he might,
if they
like,
draft Connor McDavid, they'll be better than the Leafs in 2 years.
He might, exactly. And that's another factor. That's a good factor. A good point, I should say, but a factor to take into consideration. Because he likes playing with his brother, mm-hmm. who's under contract, and he likes the new coach there, Bill Peters. Does he maybe look at this and say, okay, I've got one more year left on my contract after this year. Do I want to stay here and be part of this rebuild? And again, he's the captain, and he's only been with one franchise. So I still think that there's a good chance that he waives his no-trade clause if it means going to another team, because there's nothing stopping that team that he goes to from acquiring his brother.
Well, yeah, and you mentioned salary, as he too. You know, Gardner just re-upped, and he's at 4.05 a year in a cap hit for the next 5 years. And you look at Nazem Kadri, who's at 2.9 this year, but an RFA. So once he gets qualified and once he goes to arbitration or whatever it may be with Kadri, you're going to have both those guys making more than Staal combined. Now, of course, you have to consider the minimum player who would, you know, it's two roster spots for one and then the first round pick. But, I mean, if I'm Eric Staal, I don't want to go to Toronto. I'm going to go to a roster with Joffrey Lupo 5.25, Clarkson 5.25, Kessel at 8, Phaneuf at 7, with a cap going up, but some reports now say maybe not as much as once was anticipated. Larry Brooks mentioned that this week in the New York Post. That, couldn't you go somewhere else? I mean, I almost think staying in Carolina is better. I know it's not the attention and maybe not the pressure, but very possibly if the Canes are that bad and they get Jack Eichel, I know it's a lottery, Jack Eichel or Connor McDavid, why would he want to leave there to go to Toronto, where you could be with all of these bad contracts for a long period of time with the constant attention and pressure and, you know, the coach and the GM maybe not getting along, or the president wanting the GM out or the coach out? I mean, who wants that? Like the, and he's from Thunder Bay. He's not like from Southern Ontario. He's closer to Winnipeg than he is Toronto. And then you pass. I'd assume if he was brought into Toronto, he would brought in and be allowed to negotiate an extension. You'd think that'd be a possibility. Wouldn't you want to test the market? I mean,
and he'll have the opportunity to do that 2 years from now.
Well, or yeah, I wonder if he'd sign it away. So, I mean, this is all speculation, of course. I just think Eric Staal, I mean, he controls where he's going to go, and I just don't know why he'd want to go to Toronto. Now, of course, people need to be interested in him. And with 2 years left on his deal, maybe a team doesn't want to sign him to extension, will offer less of a package, and will say, well, we'll take him for a year and a half. And that's possible as well. But I think Ron Francis, I know he's got the no trade here, but Ron Francis has some leverage. I don't think he has no leverage, as it maybe it's been spun outside.
Well, when you talk about leverage, I mean, obviously the leverage is he has the best player. So the Carolina Hurricanes aren't going to look to trade him. This isn't probably going to be a one-for-one type of trade, right? You rarely see that with players of Eric Staal's ilk. Eric Staal's a guy that didn't make the Olympic team. I had him on the Olympic team. I mean, guys, this is a guy who hasn't had his best years over the last couple of years. He's not even 30 years old yet. So Eric Staal has a lot of good hockey ahead of him. He's usually healthy, and he's usually a guy that you can count on for 70 or 80 points. So I agree with what you're saying, Richie. There's maybe a chance, a better chance that he says, no, I like playing with my brother, and I want to be part of this rebuild, than him wanting to waive his no-trade clause. The Toronto Maple Leafs are an obvious suitor for him, and it's clear to me why the Toronto Maple Leafs are after him, because he would be their number one center.
And I know you get the best player in the trade. I don't love Nazem Kadri. I don't love Jake Gardner. So I'm not going to say, oh, you know, you're not getting the best player in the trade. I'm just saying you have a lot less flexibility if you acquire a guy like Eric Staal. And maybe you can acquire him via free agency. I mean, Toronto is not a desirable place to play. And if for some reason he wants to play there, and again, I don't know why he would, then yeah, I mean, if you're the Leafs, you have to certainly consider it.
And I agree with you. The package will have to be better than that. Eric Staal's a franchise player. I think we'd all agree with that. He is a franchise player, even at 30 years old. He can change. If he went to a team that was in desperate need to upgrade their center ice position, and it's possible if you're talking a top Western Conference team, it's probably he's playing second line center, but he's probably going to be the best second line center in the NHL.
Right.
Then you're talking about is Nazem Kadri, who struggled in his third year in the NHL, who struggled with the defensive side of the game, Jake Gardner, who's been a healthy scratch with Randy Carlyle, and the first-round pick, if it's the Toronto Maple Leafs, it's possible that's a mid-first-round pick.
If the Leafs trade another first-round pick, they're out of their minds.
I agree. So if you're talking about a package, you might have to be trading someone significantly more talented than Nazem Kadri. Because Nazem Kadri, sure, you know, you might pencil him in as a 60-point up-and-coming second-line center. But for me, when you're talking about Eric Staal, if you're trading away Eric Staal, that's similar to the Calgary Flames trading away Jerome McGinley. That's your franchise player, a guy who got you the Stanley Cup. Mm-hmm, so you're probably going to have to up that ante. Or in the case of the Carolina Hurricanes, Richie, you have to be looking at a franchise defenseman. Carolina Hurricanes are desperate for a franchise defenseman. So we've seen with L.A., with Drew Doughty, and Nashville with Shea Weber, Ron Francis might be looking at his trade options and saying, okay, I want to build my team around a franchise defenseman, not necessarily a forward.
Just looking at the Eric Staal PDF on NHL.com, and it just shows that his favorite team growing up was Toronto. So, I mean, you wonder how much of a factor that plays in. Because, I mean, if you think about it, if you get an opportunity as an NHL player to go to a team that you grew up idolizing, how much of an influence does that have? And, you know, maybe he is at the thought where he's thinking to himself, maybe he wants to return to Southern Ontario or Northwestern Ontario, as Richard pointed out, because he is from Thunder Bay. Back into Canada, we don't know, but I mean, there is always that. That's always a possibility.
Who'd want to go to the Leafs?
Well, I mean,
they talk about they break down the fights in practice between Steve Spott and Phil Kessel on where to be in the breakout, and they're really bad. Like, I don't know why a player would want to play there. I'm being serious. I don't know why a guy would want to play there if he can pick where he's going to be.
Well, I think there's a lot of players in the NHL that don't want to go there. Forget that, Richie. You touched on it a little bit.
You control it.
You touched on it a little bit.
No trade clause.
It's the spotlight. It's not so much for me where they are right now in the, I guess, success curve, because to me they're a borderline playoff team. To me, it's, do you want to go to a place where you're going to be under the spotlight? Everyone's going to see where you go to shop. Everyone's going to want to know every single thing you're doing.
It's like here times 100.
And I think a lot of hockey players, and specifically Canadian players, and, you know, Eric Staal from Thunder Bay, I think this would apply to a John Tavares. I don't necessarily know that they want to be... if you're playing for the Toronto Maple Leafs, that spotlight is bigger than anywhere, and that includes Montreal. I think the spotlight is huge in Toronto, and that's what happens when you're at the center of the hockey universe. So, again, it's something to watch, but it's kind of interesting because... it makes sense. Sure, it's his favorite team growing up, and the Leafs want that number one center, but does he want to go there? We don't know.
At least we're talking trade. Like, somebody of consequence will be traded during the year, maybe. I know past years, none of these guys are making any trades. I know the cap has been restrictive of that, but it makes for interesting conversation. And certainly when you hear Pierre LeBrun and Darren Dreger at least discussing the possibility, even if, you know, Pierre's not so sure it'll happen, and Darren thinks at least it's been bandied about. It makes for interesting discussion this early in the season. And again, I think it also, one thing we mentioned, or a couple times in this segment, is the Connor McDavid, Jack Eichel element to this. Buffalo or Carolina are like two of the worst teams that you'll see. I mean, and it's, they're not intentionally doing it. I know Tim Murray took issue with that. Tim Murray, Buffalo general manager.
No, you don't go out and sign Brian Gionta and Josh Georges if you're trying to tank.
You don't. But
well, I guess you're trying to. There's also the salary cap.
That's exactly right. Yeah, so there's many factors to take into account. There's six things that we learned this week. I didn't learn anything. I'm going to learn six things after the break. David has three, and Ezzy has three. You're listening to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, the podcast on TSN1290.ca.
If only you could see the dancing in the studio right now. Ezra Ginsberg and David Minuk. Thankfully, they are wearing t-shirts, or in Ezzy's case, a nice button-up.
Well, this is on Jock Jams. Remember that CD?
I do.
People used to listen to compact discs?
Richard Pollock filling in the host chair for Drew Mandel. You're listening to NHL Midweek with some form of the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
I'm actually going to... when Dave M's on, it's the best form.
Michael Remus is DJing tonight, and he's, you know, if you need hired help, Michael Remus will DJ your party. I've heard rumors that he can DJ a heck of a party.
Remo did a great DJ at a loft party last year. Remember that?
Yeah. Yeah, but you have to use his professional name,
like
DJ Remo.
Like, he had fans, he had groupies. It was great.
Yeah, you can put on your microphone. Are you DJ Remo?
If I need to be. If I need to be.
Remus, right now you're listening to one on your headphone on one ear, and you're putting your hand down, and you're, there's no records to spin, though.
No, I don't know. It's all digital these days, RP. Come on.
Whoa.
DJ Songza.
Just a programming note. We're on at noon. The Illegal Curve Hockey Show is on at noon on Saturday, but it'll be a variation of the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
I believe we prefer to call it Line B.
Yeah, Line...
Oh, the B team.
B team.
Michael Remus will be here.
Yep.
David Minuk will be here.
Yep.
LegalCurve.com. Special guest. And Ezzy is just special. He'll be here as well. And in the host chair won't be me.
The bearded one.
Won't be Drew Mandel.
The big one. The big show.
It'll be Matt Leibel.
That's right.
Doing Monday through Saturday work this week.
Yeah.
He's going to be hosting, and we're going to, of course, you guys are going to be recapping the Jets home opener against Nashville.
What we're going to call Saturday's show is Rolling on the Shabbos.
Just another note, we have Michael Trakos of National Post is going to be joining you guys on Saturday to talk about the Maple Leafs.
George Johnson, too, is going to come on.
George Johnson's one of our favorites. He'll be talking about the Calgary Flames, who are going to be in town on the Jets 5-game road trip. All of those games you can hear on TSN 1290. And Marty Biron is going to be the guest. I pre-taped that interview. He's going to be the guest for the second edition of Saturday Spotlight. Really interesting guy, really forthright in his comments about his career and you know, how getting drafted. And we really went through the course of his long NHL career and distinguished NHL career. And so he'll have lots to talk about. Remus will be cutting that up and have it ready to go on Saturday. There's six things that you guys learned this week, and I'm looking at number one, and Ezzy is the first one to go here, and I'm pretty sure this is one of my three things I learned this week about 2 years ago, Ezzy, but I'm going to throw it to you anyways. TJ Brody is one of the more underrated defensemen in the National Hockey League. TJ Brody, of course, of the Calgary Flames.
Yeah, I know you like TJ Brody too, Richie, but you know, maybe I just wasn't watching enough Calgary Flames last year, but I was watching...
Or listening to me on the show, which has happened before.
yeah, no, that's not the case. It's Drew that I tune out, Richie. I always listen to what you have to say. It's Drew that I tune out. I just kind of pretend that, you know, it's there's music playing or something. Maybe Remus is playing the music, but...
Playing auto-tune.
You know, I'm watching TJ Brody, and he's really established himself as an NHL defenseman the last couple years. It's his third full-time year in the NHL now. I guess maybe fourth, but, you know, Mark Giordano's there, and he's obviously the captain. He gets a lot of the spotlight, but you watch TJ Brody. He's from Chatham, Ontario, a small town in Ontario. And the guy is just very solid defensively. And I think he's... I'm going to go, you know, a little bit on a tangent here. I think if you're talking about future World Cup and Olympic teams, I think he's a guy that's that good of a defenseman that maybe, you know, you look at his point totals and he's only going to be around 30 points or so. But he does everything just really well. It doesn't necessarily... Is it the best power play player or a guy that's going to have bone-crushing hits, even though he is a physical defenseman? The guy, I think, would get so much more... attention if he was in a big American market. So I really like him, and you know, I know you like him, and I think he's somebody to watch. Just a very solid all-around defenseman. That's really the strength of that Calgary Flames team, Richie, is defense right now. You know, it's a young team, so you know, watch TJ Brody. He's a really good one.
Young defenseman is the theme of the of David's things he's learned this week. First of three is has something to do with Travis Hamonic, Manitoba native.
Yeah, from St. Malo, Manitoba. The young defenseman has been, he lost his father at a young age and does a lot of charity work with kids in the New York area. And what he does is he brings kids to the dressing room post-game, and he's been doing this since 2012. And approximately in 67 games that he's played, he's brought more than 90 children who have lost their parent at a young age, and he's trying to show them that, you know, it's a difficult thing, especially when you're young, but it's something that you can get past and you can learn to grow from. And he's, you know, he's not just the kind of guy who shows them for 10 minutes and says, okay, I did my charity work, right, and that was sufficient. He gives them his email and he says, if you need help, then you can, you know, I'm there for you at any time. And there was an ESPN E60 broadcast tonight. I think it was on TSN 1, and it's going to be rebroadcast, I'm sure. But it really shows how positive an impact a hockey player can have using his status as a hockey player and taking something so personal and something you generally don't want to share with the outside world and having an impact on young people's lives. And so it's a really interesting thing. And the fact that he does it, like I said, it's not just for show. He makes an effort after the fact. So it's a nice way to see a Manitoba boy who's proud of where he grew up, and it reflects well on him as a emerging NHL star.
Yeah, Dave, and they had Jeremy Schapp and John Minton of E60 on Hustler and Lawless before we came on, and that's going to be on at 9 o'clock Central on TSN.
Which is coming up in just about an hour and 20 minutes. Ezzy, you got to follow that one up and talk about that 70s line. Jets fans got quite a peek at them this past Sunday.
Well, you know, that 70s, I've said this many times on the show, dating back to last year's playoffs. Tyler Toffoli is one of my favorite hockey players in the NHL right now. The guy can take the puck away from you in a second, and he's got a great shot, as we saw last night against the Edmonton Oilers. But that 70s line, to me right now, it's one of the best lines in hockey. And it's one of the best lines in hockey. It's not even the number one line on the LA Kings. And, you know, this is a line that the Daryl Sutter put together during last year's playoffs. Tanner Pearson right now, it's, you know, people don't realize this. He's an early Calder Trophy candidate.
Oh,
he's,
yeah.
He's a Calder. He's Calder eligible because he played 25 games in the playoffs. In the regular season last year. So this line to me, it's one of the most dynamic lines we've seen. Jeff Carter switch from wing to center, and these guys complement him so well. They're good playmakers. As you mentioned, Richie, on Sunday night during the 4-1 loss to the Los Angeles Kings, that was the best line on the ice, in my opinion. They all scored. And, you know, this is just such a good line. And it's amazing that it's not even really the true number one line on the LA Kings. So to me, that's the number one forward line I like to watch. Bang for my buck, best line in hockey right now.
David Minuk, Brock Nelson, former University of North Dakota Fighting Sioux member, and of course Minnesota native, has been on quite a tear to start the season on the exciting to watch and really, I think, the New York Islanders team has totally changed the vibe around that organization with the acquisitions of Nick Leddy and Johnny Boychuk. But you want to speak specifically about Brock Nelson.
Well, you know, I think he's given that second line a lot of teeth with the Grabowski and Strome, and they've shown a lot of early chemistry. And yes, it's early in the season, but I mean, he's already got 4 goals and 3 assists in 3 games. I mean, that's fairly significant considering last year he had 14 goals in 72 games. So, you know, you're looking like a lot of people, and the irony, of course, is that I believe in our hockey draft, as people, when I drafted him, said, "Who is this guy?" And I said, "I think this guy is going to have some talent." And he's got, you know, he's had a year under his belt, and we'll see what happens with him. And he's shown that the Islanders are more than just a one-line team now.
Oh, for sure.
And so really, yeah, there really is a renewal of enthusiasm in New York for the Islanders. And I think he's part of it, a big part of it.
Totally reignited that fan base. I mean, if you got a chance to watch the Islanders-Rangers game last night, really good pace to that game. The Rangers are a skating team. The Islanders kind of skated them out of the building. And as you mentioned, Dave, they come at you in more than just one line now, and you'd even say four, and they have a nice mix of kind of skill, size, and aggressiveness, and you look at their defense now, and then, of course, they have Yaroslav Halak. Take in an Islanders game on TV, you're going to be pleasantly surprised. Ezzy, this last thing you learned this week, and we're pretty sure it's the last thing you've learned all week, is about a young Devils defender, and usually I'd be shaming you for talking about the Devils, but Pete DeBoer loves this guy.
He loves this guy. He's from Brandon. And not a lot of fans have heard of this guy, Damon Severson. He's 20 years old, out of Brandon. And this guy is impressing people so early on his career. Tom Giulietti yesterday tweeted out that Scotty Bowman was talking about him. So Scotty Bowman, and this is the quote or the tweet from Tom Giulietti, who we've had on the show before, covers the Devils for the Bergen Record, overheard Scotty Bowman gushing about Damon Severson's playing in the press box. That got 73 retweets, by the way. But this guy is someone who wasn't sure if he was going to make the team. He had no NHL experience going into this year. It's a guy that's straight out of the Kelowna Rockets of the WHL.
Defense factory, mind you.
Defense factory. He's now played 3 games. And he's playing so well that it's keeping Adam Larson out of the lineup, who's the 4th overall pick in the 2011 draft. So Damon Severson's a guy, big player, physical, has got some offensive ability. He's really been a nice surprise for the New Jersey Devils, a big part of the reason why they're 3-0.
Last thing that Dave learned this week has to do with Evander Kane.
Unfortunately for Jets fans, it looks like the Evander Kane watch is going to be a little bit longer than we thought, possibly, because originally when it was talked about the 2 weeks, the fans weren't sure if he was going to be skating. Coach Maurice yesterday in practice indicated that he will not be skating during these 2 weeks before he gets reevaluated, which should be approximately on October 23rd. And Coach Maurice said this: it would be a 2-week kind of resting period, and then he will get reevaluated. After that, it will be week to week. So how many games will this cost the Sniper? It's a good question. Jets fans are curious about that answer. We know it'll at least be 5 or 6 games and probably a few more after that. So It's an unfortunate fact that I learned for Jets fans, but they're going to be without the service of Evander Kane for a little while.
Did you learn that fact from IllegalCurve.com? Is that a self-plug? Like, you turn that all around?
Well, you know, you didn't let me... Yeah, I was about to say, now, if you really want that information, you go to IllegalCurve.com, a little site called IllegalCurve.com, and we would have that post up already.
It's very transparent.
I'll take this opportunity to plug Bernstein's Deli. If you're looking for a good corned beef sandwich, go to Bernstein's Deli, located in the Cordon Village Mall, Cordon at Lanark.
I feel like we're on an SNL skit, like an extension here right now. When we come back, we have one more segment to go. That'll be rapid fire. We'll see how rapid we can make it. You're listening to NHL Midweek on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN 1290.ca.
Dennis makes amends for his gaffe on Saturday's Illegal Curve Hockey Show. In the last segment of the show, he didn't play Bruce Springsteen. Although I will blame him for only playing an instrumental of Hungry Heart. It's better than nothing. Richard Pollock, final segment of NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. Drew Mandel's off this show and off next show. I'm actually going to be out of town for the next show as well. Matt Leibel
off to Toronto, the Sunshine State.
Sunshine State. Matt Leibel will be hosting this show with David Manouk and Ezra Ginsberg, who joined me in studio, and Michael Remus, who will be here as well. Before we get to the last features of tonight's show, this segment's brought to you by Bernstein's Deli, the official deli of Illegal Curve Hockey. Although, as he almost did this read before the break, conveniently located at Cordon and Lanark in the Cordon Village Mall, Bernstein's is a family-owned and operated traditional-style deli. Take it home or eat it in their full-service restaurant. Bernstein's Deli has been Winnipeg's deli destination for nearly 30 years. For more information, find them on Facebook or at bernsteinsdeli.com.
Rapid Fire.
Rapid Fire, guys, for October 15th, Wednesday, October 15th. This week, Gary Bettman announced that the Buffalo Sabres were going to be granted the 2016 NHL Draft. The question is, when the Sabres get up to the podium, will their pick be a top three?
Well, I guess a lot of that has to depend on if they get the first or second overall pick this year, because that'll significantly improve their chances. But, you know, I think it's great, by the way, that Buffalo is going to be getting the draft, because as we know, they're going to get the NHL scouting combine at the Harbor Center, which is going to be completed very shortly. I think there's a good chance they do have the top three overall pick, Richie. I know we talked about it earlier on in the show. They brought in Brian Gionta and Josh Georges, and they have a lot of good young players. But I still think this team, even with a Connor McDavid or Jack Eichel, is still going to be a bottom team when they go up to pick in 2016.
You know what? It's an interesting one, but I like as he says, I think with a pick of Eichel or McDavid this year, I think that could improve them to the point where they won't be top three. But again, it's a draft, so you never know what might happen.
Could be traded.
The AHL has adopted a new overtime format: 4-on-4 for the first 4 minutes, and after that first whistle after 4 minutes, they go to 3-on-3 until 7 minutes have passed by. Been pretty well received so far, and I'm wondering if you guys think the NHL should and will eventually adopt that.
I think absolutely they should be looking at it. And you look at what's happening in the AHL, they were talking about this in the hockey news. A lot of the games are getting decided, and that's what you want to see. There were 5 games, guys, out of the 12 games on the docket yesterday in the NHL. 5 games went to overtime, and I watched almost all of them. I have the NHL Center Ice package.
So, someone's doing well.
No big deal.
Not bad. I could put together a few loonies to afford it. But you watch those overtimes, and to me, as soon as it goes to the shootout, I turn it off and flip a coin.
I do too.
I mean, I don't want to watch the shootout.
I don't care.
You actually saw, I forget who it was yesterday, they skated over the puck. It was a rookie.
I assume I watched the shootout.
I think it was Victor Rask on Carolina. Anyways, he overskates the... I mean,
did you watch Carolina-Buffalo?
Yeah, I did.
Wow.
I have a lot of
I heard both teams lost that game.
Richie, I need a girlfriend. Let's just say
that's another show here.
Let's just say here that when you talk about overtime in the AHL and going to 3-on-3, remember Ken Holland's always talked about a 10-minute 4-on-4. I think the NHL should look at this because it's a better way, Dave, to end games.
Yeah, I'm happy to change the format to like a little bit more, to add a little more time to the game. Fans aren't going to complain about that. They're getting more bang for their buck. And, you know, it's a little bit more of an exciting format. You know, I mean, we obviously haven't seen it live, but I would imagine it's going to be a little bit more exciting to see that brand of hockey versus the shootout. I find the shootout to be too slow. I find, like, when you go from overtime and then you have to wait for the ice.
And there's no spinorama anymore.
You know what? It's just, I don't know. I'm not completely against the shootout, but I'd prefer to see the overtime.
Nobody likes the shootout anymore. I mean, even the people who liked it before, and I don't think there were that many. Obviously, people who listen to this show know I don't like the shootout, but I think the attention that it gathered early on is dissipated. The cachet is gone. Daryl Sutter this week said that he thought Oilers left winger Taylor Hall was arguably the best left winger in the NHL. Daryl Sutter does blow a lot of smoke, but do you think he's accurate in that assessment?
I think Taylor Hall, it's tough for me because to me right now, Richie, Jamie Benn is in that conversation. He's right up the top of that conversation. I think Zach Parise is up there. Mm-hmm. I think he could put a lot of players up in that conversation, but I think he is the best left winger. And, you know, he maybe hasn't put up the points yet, but I think he's probably put up 80 points, but I think he hasn't gotten to that level of top five. I think he's getting there. You have to look at who he's playing with as well, and he's had some injury issues, but Taylor Hall, the way he skates, doesn't he remind you of Mark Messier a lot of the time? Like a better Mark Messier? And they've said that since he came to the league. But I think for me, it's Taylor Hall, Jamie Benn. And I think, you know, with either of those choices, Richie, it's a good one.
The Oilers are a disaster, though. I mean, they're a disaster right now. Not that I really mind that the Oilers are a disaster, but they are a disaster. Simon Gagné was a really effective player for the Flyers for many years. And obviously, well, not so much effective with the Kings, but effective for 2002 Canadian Olympic team, and we realize that's now 12 years past. He recently signed a one-year deal with the Boston Bruins to play fourth-line left wing, at least to start out with, to try and crack their roster. Do you think he's got anything left in the tank?
It's tough to say. He didn't play in the NHL last year. And Simon Gagné came over on a professional tryout contract, and you know they didn't sign him, but now they've since sent Jordan Caron down to the AHL, Richie. Yeah. And so, as you mentioned, he's going to be playing with Daniel Paille and Ryan Spooner on the fourth line there for the Boston Bruins. Boston Bruins have scored 4 goals in 4 games. So they're having trouble scoring goals. And sure, David Krejci was out for the first 3 of the mm-hmm. 4 games, and he's only played their last game. They're obviously playing Detroit right now as we're on air.
And Krejci scored.
But what they're trying to do here is they're trying to infuse the lineup with veteran leadership and scoring. And it's tough to say. I definitely don't think you should expect 20 goals and 40 points out of Simon Gagné, but I absolutely think he can help this team, you know, and replace maybe some of the leadership that Jerome Iginla has left. But, you know, it's the big boys that got to score. It's the Patrice Bergerons, the Brad Marchands, Soderberg. He's been pretty good so far, but I think he has a little bit to give, even if that's only playing 10 minutes a game.
It's interesting to see a guy who never played the previous year and what that sort of time off can do for him, and can it help him? Because we saw with, like, you know, Timo Salani, when he had time to rest and recover from his injuries, you know, how that impacted his career moving forward. So, you know, obviously this isn't Timo Salani, but it's a question as to whether that time off could have made him, you know, healthier, maybe stronger, who knows. So it'll be interesting to see.
Final question, rapid fire, guys. Connor McDavid, got to make it quick. Connor McDavid has 18 points in 6 games so far in the OHL. Do you think he can break the record of Bobby Smith for the most points in an OHL season with 192 in 72 games? And just to note, Gretzky had 182 in 68 games.
Yeah, and you see, I wrote this question for you, Richie. You are, of course, the biggest Gretzky fan. McDavid had 99 points last year. See the connection there? 99, 99. Oh, so I think there's a chance. The only thing that's going to hurt him, Dave, is that he's going to play in the World Juniors in Toronto and Montreal. So he's going to miss usually 5 to 10 games. So the only thing that will hurt him is that. But I definitely think he's going to be close. I mean, 3 points a game right now. I think, you know, 150 points is not out of the question for him.
I think the sky's the limit for this guy, and I think he knows that all eyes are on him, and I think he's loving the attention, and I think he's going to go with it. So, I mean, do I think he'll eclipse that mark? No, probably not, but I think he's going to be a pleasure to watch.
I think the Eichel element is great because they have this rivalry in different leagues, and they want to show each other up a bit. And I think if he didn't have anybody pushing him, he might not crack that. But I think this is really getting, you know, going to be a motivating factor for him. That's it, guys.
Nothing rapid about that fire.
Yeah. That wasn't that rapid. We got it in time, though. 2 hours down, went by quick. NHL Midweek will be back next week at 6 p.m., the usual start time. But before that, listen to Saturday's Legal Curve Hockey Show with special guest hosts Matt Leibel and David Manuk. LegalCurve.com will be filling in, as well as Ginsburg will be manning the fort, not taking any time off at all. I want to thank our guests tonight's show, Ben Kuzma of the Vancouver Province, and Stu Grimson, former NHLer and TV color analyst, no longer on the radio, of the Nashville Predators, who are here Friday evening to play the Winnipeg Jets, the home opener, which you can hear live on TSN 1290, starting with the warm-up with Hasta 3, 4 o'clock HNL, and of course the pregame with the one and only Rick Rauf.
Go Royals.
World Series. For Michael Remus, for David Manuk, for Ezra Ginsburg, I'm Richard Pollock. Be sure to tune in Saturday at noon for the Legal Curve Hockey Show. Have a good evening.
You've been listening to the Legal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast.
Catch the Legal Curve Hockey Show live Saturdays on TSN 1290 and TSN 1290.ca.